Ladies and gentlemen, we all know the plot, and you do not need me to introduce you to its intricacies. Suffice it to say that in the film It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart stars as George Bailey, a man who has had to put all of his dreams on hold in order to stay in his town, take over his family savings and loan, marry and raise children, and assist all those who live in his locale, or as it is known, Bedford Falls. When, at a moment of crisis, when money that was meant to be deposited is suddenly lost, and his family savings and loan is on the precipice, he is on the brink of giving up on life. And indeed, he comes close to losing his life until he is saved by an angel, or one might say a grade two angel in waiting, with the unlikely name of Clarence. In a moment of frustration and despair, George Bailey expresses to Clarence that he wishes that he had never been born. And Clarence, surprisingly, agrees to his wish, allows him to experience what that would truly be like. This is the clip.
I suppose it would have been better if I'd never been born at all.
What'd you say?
I said I wish I'd never been born.
Oh, you mustn't say things like that. You... Wait a minute. Wait a minute. That's an idea. What do you think? Yeah, that'll do it. All right. You've got your wish. You've never been born.
You don't have to make all that fuss about it.
Experiencing a world without him in it, a world in which he has never had his children, a world in which he has never met his wife and his wife has never fallen in love with him, a world in which all the people that he has touched are utterly unimpacted by his own good deeds, allows Bailey to see what the world would truly be like without him, how many people he has truly changed and helped. And therefore, horrified by what he has seen, horrified by an experience of a world without George Bailey, he re-embraces existence and asks for his life back in a small, but I think very stirring scene, indeed one of the most stirring scenes in cinematic history.
Clarence! Clarence! Help me, Clarence! Get me back! Get me back, I don't care what happens to me! Get me back to my wife and kids! Help me, Clarence, please! Please! I want to live again! I want to live again! I want to live again. Please, God, let me live again.
Hey, George! George! You all right? Hey, what's the matter?
Now get out of here, Bert, or I'll hit you again. Get out of here.
What the Sam Hill you yelling for, George?
You...
George. Bert, do you know me?
Know you? You kidding? I've been looking all over town trying to find you. I saw your car piled into that tree down there, and I thought maybe you... Hey, your mouth's bleeding. Are you sure you're all right?
What you...
My mouth's bleeding, Bert! My mouth's bleeding!
Zuzu's petals! Zuzu...
There they are! Bert! What do you know about that? Merry Christmas!
Well, Merry Christmas!
It is an extraordinary small bit of film. First, the desperation, the longing for life, and then the sheer joy when he realizes that finally again someone knows his name, someone actually understands who he is. His life has come back, and now he appreciates what a wonderful life it truly is. Today, It's a Wonderful Life is considered one of the greatest films in cinematic history. And as I've heard my friend and editor, John Podhoretz, point out, It's a Wonderful Life was a result of a director and actor, Frank Capra and Jimmy Stewart, serving in World War II. Indeed, Stuart had courageously served as a pilot and advanced from private to a very high rank. And coming home after the war, they wished to focus not on war and devastation, not on violence, but on life and positivity. This is described in a documentary, which you can find online, about the making of the film, in which we hear from Capra and Stuart themselves. Let's see a little bit of that clip.
I was scared to death. I have not looked through the eyepiece of a camera at an actor in all that length of time. What would my first film be about? It certainly wasn't going to be about war. I had my belly full of war, and I came out a terrific pacifist. So what would it be about? A man from RKO came and he said, I've got just the story. Three powerhouse guys had written scripts on this thing. They missed the idea. I said, what idea? He said, the idea I got when I bought this Christmas card. And in about nine paragraphs, there was this story. A man who was a failure was given the opportunity to come back and see the world as it would have been had he not been born. And he finds out no man is a failure. Well, my goodness, this thing hit me like a ton of brick.
It's carried out in this unique plot because a man who thought he was a failure and thought everybody around him would have been better off had he not been born was given the chance to see how the world around him would have been, his own small little world, would have been had he not been born.
And he hired Hackett and Goodrich, two of the finest writers that have ever been in motion pictures. It's wonderful. And in 2 weeks, they had, without it being an actual happening, without it being a play, a book, or anything, this from just these little lines, just little tiny thoughts. This is the way It's a Wonderful Life originated.
I think when he came back from the war, first of all, he didn't know if he could pick up his career again because it had been so long. And did he want to? Was it trivial? You know, after what he'd been through, is just making movies and trivial? And then I think, you know, Capra came to him with this film and it was the vehicle for him to get back into filmmaking.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Having experienced war and death, Capra and Stuart wanted to focus on the meaning of life. Leaving aside Capra's own description of his embrace of pacifism, which I don't think is the lesson of World War II, it is, of course, easy to appreciate why Capra wished to focus in film on the themes explored in this incredible movie. Here, however, is the thing. Today, of course, It's a Wonderful Life is seen as one of the most inspirational movies ever made. Everyone knows it. Almost everyone loves it. But what is not now well known is that when it came out, it was seen as a failure. And even more interestingly, this seeming setback actually ultimately set up the film for its future success. Though nominated for a bunch of Oscars, none of the major ones were won by the film. Jimmy Stewart, once reflecting on this in an interview, said as follows, quote, Frank talked enthusiastically about the picture. He felt that the film and actors would be up for Academy Awards. Both of us wanted it to win, not only because we believed in its message, but also for the reassurance we needed in this time of starting over. But life, Stewart continued, doesn't work out the way we want it to. The movie came out in December 1946, and from the beginning, we could tell it was not going to be the success we'd hoped for. The critics had mixed reactions. Some liked it. Others felt it was, and Stuart is quoting a critic, too sentimental, a figment of simple Pollyanna platitudes. As more reviews came out, Stuart said, our hopes sank lower and lower. During February 1947, eight other Kern films, including Sinbad the Sailor and Betty Grable's The Shocking Miss Pilgrim, outranked it in box office income. The post-war public seemed to prefer lighthearted fare. At the end of 1947, It's a Wonderful Life ranked 27th in earnings that season. And although it earned several Oscar nominations, despite our high hopes, it won nothing. Best Picture for 1946 went to The Best Years of Our Lives. By the end of 1947, the film was quietly put on the shelf End quote. So, It's a Wonderful Life was not deemed a success, and neither really was Frank Capra's post-war career. It was the pre-war films, like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, that were seen as his masterpieces, not this one. Financially, the lack of success of It's a Wonderful Life was seen as a stroke of doom for Frank Capra's new production company. Jimmy Stewart went on, as I believe he describes in an interview, to star in dramatic films, like in Hitchcock's movies, but no Capra-esque creations were celebrated again in the same way. But here, ladies and gentlemen, is what was so unexpected. And I believe, again, I owe it to John Podhoretz for this insight. Precisely because the film was so uncelebrated and so unsung, the owners of It's a Wonderful Life allowed its copyright to expire, which it did 26 years after its creation. Thus, when TV networks needed free content that would cost them nothing, they found this film, which they were able to broadcast without expenditure during December. And the film that network executives saw as a scheduling afterthought began suddenly, decades after it was first made, decades after it was put into storage, to impact people all over America. Few refrain now from choking up while watching the end of the film as, after realizing that he's back, after being so excited even to taste snow, he runs through the town, greeting every single edifice and person that he sees. It's a Wonderful Life, in other words, was created in one generation, but it only succeeded a full generation later. The America that it depicts, that of the 30s and 40s, is very different than the America of the 1970s, the age in which it began to be embraced. Indeed, it makes sense to say that no one in the 1970s would have even considered making a film that was akin to a Capra-esque creation. But that is the precise period in which it became beloved. It made its true impact, in other words, long after its time was over. And this, in turn, gives us a profound metaphor for life itself, because this teaches us that the lives we live and what we create in our lives can reverberate far beyond ourselves, not only in our time, but in the next generation and beyond. Indeed, some of our most enduring impacts can emerge then. This point was made in a very different context by a commentary that comes, I believe, by the Gaon of Vilna, Rabbi Elio of Vilna, in a commentary on Pirkei Avot. Know three things, Akavya ben Mahalalel tells us. Know from where you come, where you are going, and lifnei mi ata atid litein din v'cheshbon, before whom you will have to offer a din and a cheshbon, literally a justification and an accounting. In heaven's eyes, in other words, we are to undergo two different examinations. Certainly the theme, of course, of the High Holy Day season. We face a din, which means judgment, and a cheshbon, a calculation or an accounting. But what are these two seemingly redundant words? What's the difference between a din and a cheshbon? Din, I believe the Gaon said, refers to judgment on the actions taken in the moment. The mitzvot fulfilled, the good deeds accomplished, the wrongs committed, the wrongs righted. But the impact of one's life, the Gaon said, extends far beyond one's life. Those whose lives we have touched then allow our own impact to reverberate far beyond our own lives. For example, in raising Jewish families, we form a link between past, present, and posterity. In impacting our community, we may actually see results of what we have done generations in the future. Thus, In evaluating one's legacy, heaven, the rabbis are saying, heaven, which is beyond time, engages not only in judgment on the choices we make in the moment, but also in calculating our cheshbon, our account, seeing our lives as investments that can bring dividends, reverberations, positive impact far into the future. This is how Jews approach time. We see ourselves as a link. We are impacted by those before, and we feel the obligation to impact those that follow. And in that impact, our lives, in a very real sense, continue. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik put it this way: to live in time and feel its rhythm, one must also move from the memory of the past to the unreality of the future. One must go, he added, from events that were and are no longer toward that which will be real someday, from reminiscing to anticipating. To live in time, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, means to be committed to a great past and to an unborn future. Time awareness also contains a moral element. her responsibility for emerging events and intervention in the historical process. Man, according to Judaism, should try to mold and fashion the future. That is exactly why he has been created as a free agent. End quote. In other words, we Jews see ourselves as part of a chain. We are impacted profoundly by those who came before. We are only Jews because of the toil, love, dedication, and sacrifice of countless predecessors. And we too, in the way we live life as Jews, have the ability, in ways that we cannot fully appreciate or predict, to bring about profound reverberations into the future. And if there is any concept that truly reifies this, ladies and gentlemen, it is the story of a film that was thought to be not successful at all, but which quite literally in the future suddenly impacted millions of lives in a way that reverberates beyond the 1970s, far, far into the future. This, therefore, is a metaphor for us, especially at this time of year, when we ponder our own lives, when we engage in both a din and a cheshbon, a judgment of the choices we made, and a consideration of how our lives can and ought to impact the future. I recently had the opportunity to reflect on this din and cheshbon in my own way when this summer I traveled to Japan and in Kobe visited one of the most remarkable synagogues I've ever seen. It's a small and beautiful sanctuary built by Rachmo Sassoon, a Syrian Jew who arrived from Aleppo in Kobe in the 1930s. And the earlier building that he had created, which existed in pre-war Kobe, was the building in which he welcomed multitudes of Jews that suddenly arrived in 1940 and 41 from Eastern Europe, when they were given visas by the heroic Japanese consul Takovno, Chiyune Sugihara. Two of those Jews that suddenly arrived in Japan during the World War II period were my maternal grandparents. And so for me to come back to Kobe, to the place where they had once been, and to attend a synagogue, to stand in a synagogue, to say Kaddish in a synagogue, that was built by a man, Rachmo Sassoon, who had once welcomed my grandparents to Kobe, that was very meaningful to me. And I spoke there in what is, I believe, as I've been told, the only synagogue that features both a Japanese Land of the Rising Sun flag and a Jewish Star Israeli flag. And flanked by these two flags, I told the story of my family, I told the story of Chiyune Sugihara, and I told the story of another heroic Japanese individual, Setsuzo Kotsuji, more of which you'll be hearing in future projects from me soon to come. Here, however, is what's incredible, ladies and gentlemen. It was only a day or two before Rosh Hashanah that I learned that years after World War II, Rabbi Marvin Toker arrived in Tokyo to minister to the Jewish community, and he sought out Chiyune Sugihara, the man who had once been the Japanese consul in Kovno, the man who had once given out the visas. He went to visit him at the company where he worked. And Chiyune Sugihara had no idea what had happened to the Jews to whom he had given these visas. Never looked into it. In other words, he was just in his consulate, and he faced desperate Jews, and he made a choice in the moment. He didn't choose to have that choice, but the choice came. He made the choice, gave the visas, but never looked into, hey, what actually happened to those Jews to whom I gave the visas? So he didn't even know in the late 1960s that because of him, there were thousands of Jews that were alive that would not have been. That there were Jews that existed, including in a very real sense, me, because of that choice that he made. In other words, he made a choice. And as far as our judgment of the choice he made, our din, to speak in Hebrew, of the choice he made, obviously we recognize the heroism and the courage. But he didn't even know what his actual accounting, what his actual cheshbon was. All he did was make a choice. But in the end, the impact extended far beyond his original choices, with reverberations far into the future. The lesson, in other words, is that we all face choices and challenges that we didn't ask for. But even though we may not know it in the moment, the reverberations from those choices can be profound. I attended this week a Brit Milah, this past week, right before Yom Kippur, of the child, the son of a friend of mine. And among the Hebrew names given to this baby was one that I never heard before, Aner. Aner is not a common name in the Torah. It's actually a name affiliated with an ally of Abraham during his battle in the War of the Four and Five Kings. So I was instantly curious why this name was being given to this baby. And the father explained that the baby was being named with this name after a young man by the name of Aner Shapira, who on October 7th heroically sought shelter with many others fleeing the terrorists. And he calmed those sheltering and told them that if Hamas and his terrorists threw grenades into the shelter, he would catch them and throw them back. And he succeeded in catching and throwing back 7 grenades. But on the 8th, he was killed. And thus it is that now a baby boy on the other side of the world is forever impacted by what one young man did. Aner Shapira's life ended all too soon. But his cheshbon, his accounting, his achievements here on earth are only beginning. In our life, in other words, there is din and cheshbon. We do not always choose the choices we face, but the impact that our choices have is enormous. Rightly understood, this is the theme of It's a Wonderful Life. George Bailey faces a whole set of circumstances that are not his choice. His original dreams of leaving Bedford Falls, of making a great name for himself, of seeking fame and fortune, all those, because of events that he did not predict, all those options have gone by the wayside. And he is in despair. But what he has shown is that the choices that he made in the circumstances that he faced had reverberations that changed so many other lives as well. The truth is that there are two quotes pertaining to the future whose sources are often cited in error, but are quite relevant to the High Holiday season, as well as to the themes of It's a Wonderful Life. The first quote about the future is wrongly attributed to Yogi Berra. Everyone thinks Yogi Berra said this. And that quote is, "It's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future." Everyone thinks that's Yogi Berra. Ask anyone, they'll tell you it's Yogi Berra. It was not, further vindicating what Yogi Berra did once say, which is, "I never said all those things I said." It's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. It is a very true quote. None of us, a year ago, Erev Sukkot, would have predicted the year that we would experience. And that's one part of life. We face challenges and choices that we do not see coming. But of course, the choices we make in the face of those challenges, and here we have the free will to choose, those choices have an impact often far beyond our imagining. And here we turn to another quote about the future, a quote falsely attributed to a man who is almost as great as Yogi Berra, Abraham Lincoln. And that quote is, "The best way to predict the future is to create it." The best way to predict the future is to create it. We don't choose our challenges, but we do choose how to respond. And in the response that we choose, we actually help create the future. All of Jewish life exists today, improbably, because of choices that others have made. And that teaches us about the value of the choices we make. The notion of din and cheshbon is not in the plot of It's a Wonderful Life per se, but the plot illustrates in a truly wonderful way how one can impact the lives of so many around them. In other words, all we know is the small span of time in which George Bailey lived. But the film itself had an impact that was intergenerational, far beyond the generation in which it was made. I was born in 1977, several decades after the film flopped. But it was only in the late 70s and early 80s when I was growing up. When I was a child, only then did the film truly become beloved. In the present, the film was seen as so-so and soon forgotten. But in the future, it became one of the most impactful of all time. The story of this film, therefore, once overlooked and now beloved, allows us to approach the very concept of time itself. The movie Now is always shown at the end of the calendar year, at a time when American society marks the passage of time, usually sometime between December 25th and January 1st. And since we as Jews are in the process of marking the transition from one Jewish year to the next, it's also worth pondering the difference through the lens of It's a Wonderful Life between the way society usually marks the passage of time and the way we as Jews do. In general, at a New Year celebration, there features a countdown with one moment, 1 second, where the old year ends and the new year begins. 10, 9, 8, 1, Happy New Year. And then everyone sings the song that It's a Wonderful Life helped make famous, Auld Lang Syne. In Judaism, the exact opposite, though, is true. It's actually never clear when one period ends and the next begins. Take the standard entry into sacred time, Shabbat. As I've discussed in other lectures, we begin the Sabbath in sunset, and we enter a period known as twilight, a mixture of dark and light, which is not definitely nighttime, but no longer fully day. We therefore wait Saturday night to end Shabbat, when the stars emerge, in order to be sure. With the new year, the same is true as well. Does the new year begin with Rosh Hashanah, so that the day after that, we are already in the next year? If that's the case, why are we still praying for a good year on Yom Kippur? And indeed, why will we be praying for a good year 8 days from now, at the conclusion of Sukkot on Hoshana Rabbah? The year turns in a series of moments that merge with one another. Jews do not count down the seconds, wait for a ball drop, and then yell, Shana Tova, and sing Auld Lang Syne. It's not how we approach time. Modern society, as Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun said, who notes this point, sees the world as discrete moments. When the day is done, he said, these are his words, I believe, we tear the page off the calendar or mark it off or move on to the next moment. But it is more appropriate to see time from a Jewish perspective, like a chain. Each is a bit slightly interconnected with the other. This is his words, quote, the perception of time in the Torah particularly, and in the world of religious thought in general, is not linear and detached. It is inconceivable from this perspective to circle specific dates in an office diary, or to tear off pages with days that have gone by. Nor is the perception a legal contractual one, where the date is nothing but a device to be used for thoughtful and fair management of the complex relationships between people with their inclinations and their disagreements. Rather, the religious view of time is built on a consciousness of continuity, cyclical repetition, and remembrance. In a continuous consciousness, Rabbi Ben Nun went on, no day stands alone. It is always connected with the previous day and the following day in a chain of successful links as reflected in the Hebrew expression miyamim yamima, meaning year in, year out. In a cyclical consciousness, neither a day nor a period can stand alone. They are part of a chain that connects them to periods that have already come and gone, and especially to the parallel period last year and in previous years. They also look into the mist of the period that is to come and of future years. So Rabbi Ben Nun writes, so, in our approach to time, one moment does not disappear, or one decade does not disappear. A small act of kindness can change the future that follows. A seemingly minor mitzvah reverberates beyond our expectations, and a film in one decade can suddenly impact many decades in the future. Frank Capra Jr., speaking about his father, said that, quote, just like its hero George Bailey, the film went through times of optimism and despair. Also like George Bailey, the film was rescued by his friends, end quote. And here he's referring to the end of the film, when George Bailey comes home to find that the town has raised the money needed to save the savings and loan. Frank Capra Jr. is right, of course, but here the film was rescued long after it was created. Or, as Capra adds, quote, the film might not have made a fortune for my father or for the others who worked on it, but it has enriched the lives of every person who ever fell under its warm, joyful spell. Thus, does the enduring power of It's a Wonderful Life, far beyond the age when it was created, capture for Judaism the nature of time itself? Unlike the moment of midnight, the drop of a ball, the clang of a clock which is heard and then silenced, mark the moment that is there and then is gone. From the Jewish perspective, a moment can endure, influence, impact it far beyond the time in which it originally occurred. I've often contrasted the food of Rosh Hashanah with its secular drink of New Year's, champagne. The momentary effervescence of sparkling wine is what gives it its excitement. But we know, if you've had champagne, that it will soon go on, it will soon go from fizzing to flat. In contrast, the traditional food eaten by Jews on Rosh Hashanah, honey, is, as I explained in my special presentation that I did with Avi Snyder on the foods of the new year, especially the memorable moment in which I ate from the head of a sheep, a moment from which I think Avi is still not recovered. Honey, as I explained, is a food that scientifically is interesting because it never spoils. And it reminds us, therefore, to treasure and to enjoy the pleasures in life that are truly enduring. We Jews mark a moment with honey in order to teach us that moments, if treasured and spent wisely, like honey, do not disappear. And when we understand time that way, we are reminded that we are obligated to build on the past and prepare for posterity. It is indeed difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. We can't predict what challenges we face, but how we face them creates the future. This is worth bearing in mind as we ponder the past year, which has been a difficult year indeed. In Jewish history, there have been many years of difficulty and pain, of course, but this has been a particularly tough one for our recent memory. But in Judaism, when it comes to difficult moments such as these, we do not forget those moments, but allow the lessons learned, the sacrifices seen, the heroism exhibited, to impact our own lives, our own memories, our own actions, as we seek to impact the future, as the past has so profoundly impacted us. Here, too, the enduring nature of honey, contrasted to champagne, allows us to understand this. One of the few scenes in the Bible featuring bee honey involves the flawed but heroic judge Samson, who we are told by the book of Judges was once attacked by a lion and he killed it. Later he came upon the carcass of the lion and he saw that bees had built a honey hive within the lion. And seeing the dead carcass teeming with life, he scooped up the honey and as he ate, he coined a riddle to describe what he had seen. Me'ha'ochal yatzah ma'achal u'me'az yatzah matok. From the devourer came forth sustenance and from the fierce came forth the sweet. It is a fascinating phrase, from the fierce came forth the sweet. But it is, of course, the story of our own people. Lion after lion, beast after beast, attempted to devour us. But even in the face of savagery, our ancestors rebuilt, and they filled their own lives with the equivalent of honey, with the sweet aspects of life that were truly enduring. They didn't seek to forget the very difficult moments in history. They marked fast, they remembered moments of destruction, but that also allowed them to better appreciate what was sweet and enduring about life, or, in the words of the film, to appreciate what was truly wonderful about life. So in any trying experience, the goal must not be merely to bid it goodbye, but to bear it with us into the future, a reminder of what we often take for granted, the frailty and fragility of life, the privilege of what it is to be part of a covenantal community and people, the blessing that is the presence of our loved ones, the privilege of having others in our lives. Jimmy Stewart in war would see great violence and suffering, and later in his life he would see other tragedies. But his refusal to forget the suffering he had seen was actually what impacted the power of his performance in this film that went on to bring meaning to the life of millions. In an interview years later, Stewart described why, as a religious man, the experience of creating It's a Wonderful Life was so emotionally important, and why one of the most extraordinary examples of his acting in the film was to a great extent unscripted. Let us set up this scene. At his great moment of crisis with the money lost, he is sitting in a bar that was run by a man with the 1940s film name, Giuseppe Martini, and he suddenly bursts into prayer. Let's show the clip.
Ah, Merry Christmas! Glad you come.
Oh.
How about some of that good spaghetti?
We got everything.
Say love you,
God. Oh, God. Dear Father in heaven, I'm not a praying man, but if you're up there and you can hear me, show me the way. I'm at the end of my rope. Show me the way, oh God.
Again, the words of his prayer. God, dear Father in heaven, I'm not a praying man, but if you're up there and you can hear me, show me the way. I'm at the end of my rope. Show me the way, God. In an interview, Stewart said that when he uttered these words, quote, I broke down sobbing. This was not planned at all, but the power of that prayer, the realization that our Father in heaven is there to help the hopeless, had reduced me to tears. And Stewart added that Frank Capra had not asked for such emotion, actually. But he said that, quote, Frank, who loved spontaneity in his films, was ecstatic. He wanted a close-up of me saying that prayer, but was sensitive enough to know that my breaking down was real and that repeating it in another take was unlikely. But Frank got his close-up. So the emotion in this film, in other words, was utterly unplanned, and it drew on the difficult experiences in Stewart's life in the past. So that someone who understands sadness brings it to a role that in the end helped bring others great joy, a role with which so many came to identify. In the story of a film that teaches us that at times may az yatsa matok, out of the fierce can come forth the sweet. Thus, the film reminds us that there are aspects of life that truly contribute to one's cheshbon, to one's enduring account, and that these are the honeys in our life, the greatest source of joy and the most enduring contribution. Or, as the conclusion of It's a Wonderful Life puts it, in a scene that takes place in a very not Jewish setting, but which gives us a lesson that is very Jewish indeed.
Christmas present from a very dear friend of mine.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right.
Jimmy Stewart was a fascinating man, a Hollywood actor of another era, one who served with distinction in the military, and a man who allowed what he had seen in war to impact him afterward. He went from stardom in the 30s to the horror of World War II in the 40s. But that inspired him to appreciate and embrace a script that not everyone embraced at first, and to bring the pathos of his performance to the movie, making it one of the greatest in the history of American film. He did not forget what he had seen. He allowed it to impact him. He did not get the Oscar that year. But the truth is, none of us remember who did. But the man who built on his experiences is remembered for what he did here. And he reminds us thereby, not only in the plot, but also in the journey that his film took from failure to success, that often, from the fierce, we can make choices that help ensure the sweetness of the future. The British journalist Douglas Murray was recently asked in an interview why it is that after the horrors of October 7th, he instinctively felt he had to go to Israel and report it from Israel and become one of the most eloquent defenders of Israel and of the Jewish people. And as part of the interview, this is an interview with Barry Weiss, Barry said to him something like, you know, Douglas, your friends say that since then you've become much more optimistic. And so the implicit question is, why are you doing this? And why have you gotten so much more optimistic in the face of the horrors that you've seen. And as part of his answer, Douglas cited something that he heard from Rabbi Sacks over a decade and a half ago. As Douglas described, this was during the time of the New Atheists, when British writers were, like Richard Dawkins, were writing best-selling books. And some of these atheists came up with an idea for a campaign on a bus, which said something like, "Probably there's no God, so just relax and enjoy your life." And Douglas heard Rabbi Sacks say something like, as Douglas tells it, "That's a very interesting word, probably. It's doing a lot of work in that ad." And then Rabbi Sacks said, "Nothing in life is probable. The fact that we exist is improbable. The fact that we exist on this planet, which has the conditions for us to survive, let alone thrive, is improbable." And then Rabbi Sacks added to Douglas, "The fact that there is a resurrected Jewish state is improbable." And the story of the Jewish people, the story of the Jewish state, Rabbi Sacks said, is the defeat of probability by the power of possibility. As Rabbi Sacks wrote, "The prophets dreamt the improbable, and by doing so, helped to bring it about." And so Douglas said that if he had gotten more optimistic, despite all that he's seen, despite the horror he has heard, despite the bombings and the missiles, it is because, as he put it, he has seen in the survival of the Jewish people the survival of hope. The story of the Jewish people is, of course, a story of sweetness coming forth from fierceness. But it's the story of the survival of hope because of choices made in each generation, choices in the face of unpredicted challenges that nevertheless help to create the future, reverberating far beyond the time in which the choice was made. Like the movie It's a Wonderful Life, which seemed to be a failure, but ultimately changed the lives of countless people and changes them still. We may not often see the full fruition of all the deeds we do, but that does not mean that the cheshbon, the impact, is not there. It is difficult to make predictions, especially about the future, but one prediction can be made because it's already on the schedule. A little bit later this new year, the granddaughter of Rachmo Sassoon, the man who welcomed my grandparents and countless other Jews to Kobe, Japan, the granddaughter of Rachmo Sassoon will be getting married, not in Kobe, but in New York City. The officiant at this wedding will be Meir Soloveitchik, grandson of two Jews that arrived in Kobe. If you would have said in 1940, 1941, or especially in 1943, that the grandson of two Jews that fled from Eastern Europe, losing almost their entire family, arriving in Kobe, would be officiating at the wedding of the grandchild of one of the Sephardic Jews that welcomed them to Kobe, and they would be standing together some 80 years later under a chuppah. Probably, if you would have been told this at a time when it seemed that the entire Jewish world was in danger of being lost, people would have said that was improbable. But it will be happening. And it will be happening because Jews in the 1940s, like my grandparents, and like Rachmo Sassoon, facing challenges they could never have predicted, nevertheless made choices on behalf of their faith, on behalf of their continuity, that helped to create the future. It is often difficult to predict what impact our choices will have, but the choices of acts of courage and sacrifice and faith, of creations of goodness and inspiration, reverberate far beyond our own time. If there is a film that whose history gives us a metaphor for this truth, it is It's a Wonderful Life. And that is why learning the story of its failure and of its ultimate success makes the film and our own experience of it just a little bit more wonderful. Thank you very much.